Bill Derezowitz grew up on the East Coast in a liberal Jewish family.
Good evening, I'm Bill.
His parents listened mostly to local news radio. Lots of blaring headlines that felt shallow to him.
And what authorities feel may be another case of murder-suicide.
Then he discovered something new.
Right. So I was 23. It was 1987. I was just starting adulthood. And I was just looking around on the radio one day for something to listen to. And I stumbled on this thing that was unlike anything I'd ever heard before. I'll never forget it. They were in the middle of what ended up being like a 22-minute segment on the Appalachian Trail, people hiking the Appalachian Trail. This was like early summer, so it was a good time for it. And it was patient, it was intelligent, it was curious. And it turned out that it was a program called All Things Considered on a network called National Public Radio, neither of which I'd ever heard before. And I think this is the experience that a lot of people have had. A lot of people, dare I say, like us, by which I mean sort of the educated liberal elite, which is that NPR just became the soundtrack of my life.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
And it was All Things Considered when I got home in the afternoon, and Morning Edition when I woke up first thing in the morning, and Fresh Air every day and on the weekends.
You know, Arvid, I think you and I need to talk about vulnerability.
You know, Prairie Home Companion and Car Talk. Weekend Edition Saturday with Scott Simon, who I guess is still doing it somehow.
It's a dark story told in a bright place, the South Florida coast, out past where the lights of Miami dim and the sound of cicadas is up full.
Basically, that's where it was at. I mean, I listened to NPR for several hours a day, every day of my life, pretty much, from 1987 until about 2021.
This is How My View Grew, the show that dives deep into humanity's challenges by looking at big thinkers who have changed their minds. I'm Amiel Handelsman. Bill Derezowitz first came to my attention several years ago through his book, Excellent Sheep, which was a New York Times bestseller. I discovered it during a period when I was thinking hard about where to send our sons for high school. Now, although Excellent Sheep is about college, and in particular the Ivy League and other highly selective schools, someone told me it would put the whole experience of growing up into perspective, which it did. The book is a strong critique of a system that encourages careerism and hoop jumping instead of carving a meaningful path in life. The book also felt to me like it gave a big hug to young people who get caught in that system. Many years ago, I was one of those people, so the book really landed for me. More recently, I was talking with a colleague who's known Bill since childhood. She said that in recent years, he's changed his mind about politics in big ways.
But you're right. I mean, this is all sort of in my late 50s, which, for one thing, I think is great. I'm patting myself on the back, but I mean, personally, I'm grateful to know that I can have such significant changes of perspectives this late in life. That, you know, I haven't done all of my learning and all of my thinking.
So back to 2020, when Bill started to feel uncomfortable with NPR and many other news sources he had trusted for a long time, he began to branch out, began to take in people and perspectives that he previously wasn't aware of or had discounted or ignored. As you listen to Bill's story, you may say to yourself, yeah, I've had an experience just like that, and with just that radio station or newspaper. Or you may still be a fan of the news sources that Bill lost trust in, or maybe they were never your cup of tea to begin with. In other words, Bill's current political thinking and the shift that he's made could be a lot like yours or very different. But either way, what I think you'll find valuable is how Bill makes this discovery. It's a set of experiences that will be familiar to most of us, even if the details are a bit different. It's when you start to notice that places you turn to for news and opinion might not be telling you the whole story. And you start to say to yourself, I wonder what else is out there.
And so what happened in 2020, 2021? I think the whole thing shifted. I mean, I remember it was especially after George Floyd. I started to see very clearly and very quickly that I was being sold a particular line about not only how to view the world, but what the world was, right? It was clear that I was not getting the full story. I mean, you could see with your own eyes, for example, that not all the protests were nonviolent. And also just kind of a language that had started to permeate the network, that was a language that I recognized from my years as an English professor. First a graduate student and an English professor, the language of critical theory, the language of the academic humanities and social sciences, which I had been skeptical of from the moment I first encountered it in the 1990s. And my listening to NPR quickly just became hate listening. I mean, I would tear my hair out, among other things, because we were no longer getting more than one point of view. You know, they would have one, they wouldn't have two people on. I'm not going to say from different sides, because that makes it sound like I want this sort of, you know, you just sort of listen to a Republican, you listen to a Democrat, and you, I mean, that kind of supposedly balanced or quote unquote objective journalism. That's not what I'm looking for. I'm just looking for the recognition that there's more than one way to see things. In fact, there's more than two ways. We weren't getting that anymore. We were just getting one version from an academic, from an activist, from a progressive politician. But I didn't know what else to do. I didn't know that there was anything else to listen to.
Then sheer dumb luck happened. Bill was coming out with a new book, not about politics, but about the lives of artists, and was invited onto a podcast to talk about it. He didn't even listen to podcasts at that time.
But it was Megan Dom's podcast, the writer Megan Dom, whose podcast is called The Unspeakable. And we had a great conversation. And I started to listen to her podcast. And I discovered that there was this whole world, and I know there hasn't been a good word discovered for this, because none of them is satisfying. You know, first it was called the intellectual dark web, which is kind of a ridiculous term. And now people just call it the heterodox world or their heterodox space, whatever it is. But there was the point is there was an entire conversation happening, and it's still happening and continuing to expand on podcasts, on Substack, in various publications, many of which didn't exist 4 or 5 years ago, that isn't the orthodoxy on the left, and it isn't the orthodoxy on the right.
Yes.
And I think the best way to define what it means to be heterodox is simply that you don't prejudge any issue, and you treat each issue as a separate thing, not like you kind of like check your wallet to see what you believe, and that will tell you what to think about any given thing.
Yes. Yeah. What I found interesting, I went and listened to that interview. You've done two or three with Megan Dom, that first one. I was expecting the conversation to be about George Floyd and politics, and it was about your book about artists and making money. It was a great conversation about that. And it sounds like you felt a certain type of connection with her that gave you the curiosity to listen to other people she had interviewed.
Right. So I felt a connection with her, which made me start to listen to other episodes of her podcast. And then in the course of that, of her podcast, she would mention yet other podcasts that I started to investigate. And I should say, as I was questioning NPR, I was also questioning all the print sources that I've been consuming, like The Times, The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, basically, I think by this point, a lot of people understand, a lot of people have had this experience, a lot of people will understand what I'm about to say. That a very particular ideology, which also does not name itself, right? It rejects any name that's been given to it, but a particular framework for understanding the world, which grew out of the academic humanities and social sciences that I encountered in an earlier form 35 years ago when I started graduate school, that can be called critical theory or critical social justice or whatever you want to call it, has become the default framework through which to understand the world on the part of most of the self-appointed interpreters of reality for the liberal elite, the people who basically run the cultural and not just cultural institutions of the country and indeed of the West. You know, as soon as you start to talk about this with people, they will tell you that they've had the exact same experience. They don't know what to trust anymore.
Yes.
Right? I mean, how much can I trust the New York Times? I don't actually think it ever tells me anything that isn't true, although sometimes it turns out that it does tell me things that aren't true.
It leaves out errors of omission.
Errors of omission, except to call them errors is, I think, to be too generous.
Okay. Okay. So you discovered with NPR other sources of news that you trusted less. They were leaving out very important perspectives. One of the things you admired and loved about NPR originally was this sense of openness to different perspectives, clear thinking, something that you clearly valued now and valued when you were in your 20s. I wondered if we could just go back in time a little bit to what the time period you were talking about before, particularly around the critical theories that you saw in colleges and universities. And you described in an email to me that they were, for many years, they were largely an intramural affair, meaning they were within the walls of the university. I'm wondering, how did you relate to those when you were a professor and even before that, a graduate student?
Oh, right, right. I've written about this too, if anyone's interested, for a different heterodox publication called, you know, Quillette, the essay is called Why I Left Academia, Since You're Wondering. And it's also in my collection, The End of Solitude, which came out a couple of years ago. I always rejected critical theory. I always thought it was ridiculous and disconnected from reality and Manichaean and absolutistic. I think you used the word earlier, humility. And when you just a minute ago, when you repeated what I said I liked about NPR, you said clear-minded, and that's true. But there was a sense of humility, right? They were not the host did not set themselves up as intellectuals, right? I think so. This is what one of the things I hated so much about academic theory was a complete lack of humility and a complete lack of common sense and a very clear will to power, a will to power over others and over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we see in the media now. I mean, basically what's happened is that in the 35 years since I started graduate school, the institutions of culture have been populated by students who went through those kinds of departments as undergraduates or as graduate students. They are now speaking that language and employing those concepts. So they always have the same answer no matter what the question is.
Mm.
And you always know what they're going to say. You always know what Charles Blow or Tressie McMillan Cottom is going to say.
Mm-hmm.
Because they always say the same thing.
Yeah, because part of what I was wondering, and I had a hunch, but part of what I was wondering is whether you found some of that approach to thinking and philosophy, you ever found it appealing. My guess was no, but whether you found it appealing and realized in 2021, oh, this is really not helpful and it's gone mainstream, or whether you had a distaste for it going back years and just assumed it was going to stay in academia. And then,
yeah, right. It's not that what I changed my mind about was not whether critical theory was worth a damn.
It was about the
entire non-academic left or liberal sphere, which was taken over by critical theory.
Right.
That's the point.
Well, let me ask you this. I'm going to quote another line from that Unheard piece that I think exemplifies humility. You change your mind when you consent to stop ignoring things you know full well, but do not want to think about, things that you push to the edges of consciousness or all the way out. So as I read that, I was wondering, what were the things in hindsight that you were pushing out or to the edge?
Yes. I have a couple of big examples. The first one has to do with that book that you mentioned that I went on Megan Daum's podcast for, which it's called The Death of the Artist, a regrettable title that my publisher insisted on. But it's about the dire state of the arts economy now for individual creators. And I went into, so this was really before my NPR epiphany, but I went, when I started working on that book around 2016, 2017, I went in with an attitude about art and money that was kind of the typical attitude, which is that, you know, art should never come anywhere near money. Money corrupt to art, the market corrupt to art, market bad, capitalism bad. And I realized that that was bullshit. I mean, I realized that actually one of my first interviews was with an old student of mine who's become an indie filmmaker. And the book came out of an article that I published in 2015. And he said, you know, that article, you're just doing the same. You're part of the problem, right? Because the problem is that young artists are told not to think about money. That's the problem. And they're told not to think about money because they're told that, you know, money, you know, any thought about money is selling out, is corrupting. But how are you supposed to make a living? And that really jolted me. And I also, so it wasn't just an attitude, as I pieced together the history that I present in that book, it's not mainly a history, but I do talk about this, I realized that actually capitalism liberated art from patronage. Okay, before capitalism came to the arts in the 18th and 19th centuries, artists were beholden to their patrons in the aristocracy and the church. And this idea of artists as people whose job it is to speak truth to power did not exist. It only came to exist as a result of the freedom that capitalism gave the arts, basically the freedom to appeal directly to an audience and make a living by selling your stuff into the market. But this changed my whole attitude about the market and about capitalism, right? I don't know that politically I changed that much in the sense that I've always believed in regulated capitalism, but I don't believe that capitalism is an evil that is better eliminated. And partly because I thought more seriously about what would it mean to replace it? What would we get instead? We would get a command economy. Do I want to live in a command economy? Do I want to live in an economy where the state is deciding how to distribute resources? No, I don't. It doesn't mean that I think contemporary capitalism doesn't have a lot of problems. I do, and it needs a lot more constraint than it exists under now. So that's a big thing. And the other big thing, and I'll be perfectly honest with you. So once I had this, you know, the NPR epiphany and blah, 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 and realizing that I just had, there's just so much that I had just kind of taken for granted growing up as a typical progressive, liberal, leftist, whatever you want to call it. I not only started listening to and reading heterodox people more, but also conservatives. Mm-hmm. Okay. Not Trumpy conservatives, but, the conservative columnists in the Times, who I think are some of the smartest people who write for the Times, Ross Douthat, Bret Stephens, David Brooks, who still considers himself conservative, although I think he's actually a socialist. But it's not that I agree with these people. They're worth listening to. And Bret Stephens wrote a column about the role of American empire. You know, American empire is another thing that you're supposed to hate. And he said, look, the main benefits of American power are the things that don't happen. Mm-hmm. It's what's allowed Australia not to have to worry about domination by China, mm-hmm. and therefore to develop as a free society, Japan and then China. And we could say the same thing about Western Europe and so on and so forth.
Yeah. So can I interject? You have conservatism and capitalism. For many years, you had a particular take on them.
Well, but conservatism for sure, but I'm saying empire, American empire.
Empire as well.
The two things you're supposed to hate and want to eliminate, capitalism and the American empire. And I just took that for granted. And again, so partly it's recognizing the good things that those things do, and also thinking more seriously about what would you have if they disappeared? What would we have if the American empire disappeared? Would we have a peaceful family of nations? Everyone holding hands and singing Kumbaya? No, we wouldn't. We would have a Chinese empire. And what would that look like?
Mm-hmm.
Or a Russian empire or sphere of influence?
It's one of the limitations of deconstruction is that you argue for the elimination of something, but you don't play it out logically of what would happen next. In the sense, if you're saying down with empire, down with capitalism, that's a great slogan. Well, maybe not such a great slogan, but you're saying, okay, take it away. Now what? Let's play out the scenario. Is that what we really want?
You're hearing me absolutely correctly. I would add to that that it's been a feature of the left for many decades now, and plenty of people on the left have remarked on this, that the left no longer even really has a vision of what will replace it in the way that it would have, you know, when Marxism was ascendant. What I think it has is just a very unexamined, and I was this way too, a very unexamined kind of utopianism, which is also based, I think, on absurd, unspoken assumptions about human nature or what human beings are capable of. You know, if only we eliminated, you know, the repressive hand of the state, people would live cooperatively and be nice to each other. Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, maybe 90% of people would, but you still have to account for the other 10%, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so forth. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is really helpful. Thank you. We're talking about things that maybe you blocked out and then you started to see and take in and see differently and reconsider. And I just want to go back in time again, because part of what I'm investigating here is that when we saw things a certain way, it made sense at the time. It made sense based upon who we were, the people who were around us, the reward systems that influence us, the zeitgeist. So could you just say more about what you were in and surrounded by as you had these particular critiques of capitalism and empire? Just paint a little more of that story, if you could.
Oh, sure. You know, I mean, I grew up in an upper middle class, professional class suburb of New York. My dad was a college professor. He wasn't particularly far to the left, but, you know, my parents always voted Democratic. I was born in 1964, so I kind of grew up with sort of the after echo of the 60s and that idealism about what the world could look like, about how politics should be conducted. And then, I mean, I was, you know, we know each other through a person who I know ultimately through a progressive Zionist youth movement that I was part of. And that might sound oxymoronic to some people, but it was progressive and Zionist. So it was socialist, basically, as much as, you know, early Zionism, or most of early Zionism was socialist. And then, you know, I mean, I lived in New York, I lived in Boston. I mean, I lived entirely in this world where everybody's on the left, everybody thinks that way. Nobody questions that everything to the right of the left is evil and not worth thinking about. Nobody pushes on the assumptions that we all share about capitalism and empire and utopian possibilities and so on and so forth. So I mean, I think it was, you know, some details notwithstanding, I think it was broadly speaking the way many, many people in, I would say, our class, the professional managerial class, have grown up and have been shaped. And what's so terrible now is that bubble, the walls of that bubble have gotten stronger and stronger and stronger because of the dynamics of the internet. We're all sorted into our own silos because of what's happened to institutions like NPR and The Times, although The Times seems to be kind of backing away from it a little bit. But, you know, we're getting even less exposure than we once would have gotten to reasonable people who disagree with us.
Yes. Yes. What I'm picking up from your description of the environment in which you grew up, particularly knowing that you made breaks from your past as a young man, you've written about, you know, stepping away from your father or family's plans for you to be a physician.
Yes.
Right. That was a, call it a self-authoring move at an early age.
Yes. And even earlier, when I was 15, I grew up in an Orthodox Jewish community, and I broke from that too.
So what's interesting here, so it's almost like peeling an onion as one metaphor, is we're kind of peeling away layers of the forces that socialize us, and some went, we pushed them away very quickly, and some stuck for longer, if I'm not, and then we also probably ought to bring in Excellent Sheep and your critique of elite education, which I don't even recall, I just reread the book, but whether you actually loved that system for some period of time and then got disabused of it or not.
Sure, I did, absolutely. You're making a very good point as you trace this pattern across my life. Did I love the system of elite education? I'm not sure love is the best word.
Okay.
I mean, it's not that I disliked it. I bought into it. I bought into that system of evaluation, right? If you went to the better the school you went to, the better a human being you were, you know, sort of the more valuable a human being you were. These were necessarily the best places to go to school. They gave you the best education, et cetera, et cetera. Those are all the things that I ultimately started to question and wrote about in Excellent Sheep. And it involved a big change in the way that I saw myself, because I had seen myself as, you know, better than everyone who hadn't gone to an Ivy League school.
Yeah, yeah, that resonated for me. I didn't go to an Ivy League school, but I went to one of those adjacent ones. And I wanted to share just an important aside about that book for those who haven't read it. I read it 3 or 4 years ago when I was thinking about our son's future. And several weeks ago when we got introduced, what I remembered about the book was the critique of the careerism, the meritocracy, the maintenance of status that you're mentioning here.
Yeah.
But what I forgot and remembered when I reread it a week ago was the compassion for the students and the young people who are suffering through this. It's almost like I missed that the first time. And so when I went through it again, I felt like, wow, okay, this is coming from someone who's probably been through this himself.
Oh, of course, of course. But it's good because the compassion, it's not that the compassion came later for me, but I think articulating that came later. Because again, that book was also grew out of an essay that I wrote several years earlier that was called The Disadvantages of an Elite Education, that was pretty sour and angry. I didn't actually think any students would even see it. And so I didn't take care to express any compassion for them, although I did feel it. But one of the things that happened as a result of that essay, which was based on my observations of my students at Yale, and you know, a lot of people wrote to me, and the big piece that I hadn't known even then was how miserable it was making them. Right. I mean, it was careerist, it was anti-intellectual, but the depth of anxiety and sometimes even despair that it caused was a revelation to me. Even though I knew my students well, I thought I knew my students well, but after the essay came out, I started to get all of these emails from people, very long confessional emails about how unhappy they were with all of this. And I think it's that compassion that you registered in the book version in Excellent Sheep.
Mm-hmm. And you paid attention to it, just like, again, to draw another thread, you paid attention to that first artist that you interviewed who said, you know,
yes,
Bill, your dichotomy of the market and art is off base, man. You listen to these people.
Yes. And not only did I pay attention to it, I realize now why I gave you that whole spiel.
Sure.
Is that when I talk to young people, as I've done many times since Excellent Sheep came out, people at colleges, at high schools, people who just email me, I say to them, pay attention to your own feeling. Don't listen to me. Don't trust me when I tell you that maybe this treadmill of achievement that's never going to end is not worth it. Don't listen to me. You don't know me and I don't know you. Listen to yourself. And again, to quote something you said earlier, listen to the things that you have been trying to block out.
Yeah. Going back to Excellent Sheep, one of the other dimensions of the book that really struck me was the absence of support for meaning, for living a meaningful life as opposed to, in these institutions, as opposed to jumping through hoops, and the encouragement and nudge to self-author, right? And to look inward and what am I feeling? What matters to me? So I really picked that up. And then now just fast forward to what we're calling wokeness. There is something similar to that, which is I'm having this inner experience and this conversation is triggering me. You need to stop. We need to get rid of this class. That's my inner experience. I'm authoring it. So I wondered if you maybe could distinguish those two different representations.
Sure. And if I can cite yet another book of mine that hasn't come up yet, my first commercial book, A Jane Austen Education, where I talk about, I mean, I mainly talk about Jane Austen, but I frame it by talking about how reading her novels in my 20s helped to change me. And one of the big ideas in the chapter on Pride and Prejudice, because this is a big thing in Pride and Prejudice, is the idea that you can have a feeling about something, but the feeling can be wrong. It can be wrong if it's based on false information. When that book was going through press, the one idea that various, you know, editors and readers kept challenging was that idea. You know, like, how can you say that an emotion is wrong? Because it's really become a kind of a bedrock of kind of contemporary kind of therapeutic culture. Like, anything you feel is valid. Well, what if it's based on just, you know, as it is in Pride and Prejudice, she thinks Mr. Darcy has done X, he actually did Y. And when she finds that out, she discovers that her feelings about him were completely mistaken. So analogously, I would say that when students feel triggered, or they say that they feel triggered, first of all, I think you need to examine that feeling a little more carefully. Is it really based on an accurate perception of the situation? But even if it is, this is a slightly different point than the one I just made. A feeling can be true and real. What you do about that feeling isn't obvious. You know, like, okay, you're feeling discomfort. So then what?
Quick pause to appreciate an important distinction Bill is making. It's one thing to acknowledge the validity of my feelings, and another to assume that these feelings capture facts of what's happening around me. These are really different. As the person having the feelings, I have the authority to name them. You can't tell me how I'm feeling. I get to do that. Now, it may or may not be useful to share these feelings out loud, but these are my feelings, and I have the authority to name my feelings. However, this authority to name my feelings does not apply to what's happening around me. When I make an assertion about what's happening around me, whether that assertion is true or false is not determined by my feelings, however real those feelings may be. For example, you say something and I immediately feel frustrated. My feeling frustrated doesn't automatically prove that you are harassing me or creating an unsafe environment, for example. Nor does it mean that what you said was racist or sexist. Now you might be harassing me, and your words might reflect racism or sexism, but my feelings alone, without any reference to what you did or your intentions or a standard for assessing these things, aren't sufficient evidence to prove that. They're just not. Ironically, when we assume that our feelings determine what's factually true around us, or that our feelings are all we need to ground assessments of others' actions or intentions, we're allowing our feelings to, yes, colonize everything else. Is this such a good idea? Now, back to Bill.
Is the answer to shut down the speech of the person who's making you uncomfortable? No, it's not. Certainly not in a classroom setting. So that's what I would say. I mean, it's very important. One sort of stage of development is to become more aware of what you're feeling.
Yes.
The next stage is to decide what to do with it. I mean, this is a very good thing to know in intimate relationships, for example.
Yeah.
You're angry. Okay, what are you going to do about that?
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I want to ask a related question, which are back to meaning again, which is in Excellent Shape and in your talks and other writings, you know, you really make a passionate case for help for people discovering what's meaningful to them. I could now argue that many of these young people who are revolting against the system, and, you know, when I lived in Portland a few years ago, where you now are, were attacking buildings, burning buildings, yeah, and whatnot, that they said, "Bill, fantastic. We're not jumping through career hoops. We got something else that helps us feel meaningful. Thank you for that tip, Bill. Yeah. We're following through on it." So how would you respond to that?
One thing I would say to them was like, "Well, the Proud Boys that you're having street fights with could say the same thing, right? It's very meaningful for them."
Yes.
I think, of course, it's important to live a life that you feel is meaningful to you, but that isn't the end of the question.
That's not all of it. In other words, you've long believed in standards of excellence. You've written about quality of people's writing and thinking needing to go up a notch, yeah, in certain places where you wouldn't expect it, yeah, to. And also around facts and laws, like paying attention to meaning doesn't mean ignoring other people's perspectives or facts or standards. It's in addition to it. And maybe what I'm hearing is that there's what I call all aboutism, which is this whole thing is all about my search for meaning and my protest. And they're
right,
including it. You're saying, no, got to include these other things as well.
Yes. And actually, as we talk about it, you're making me realize that meaning is very closely connected to the last thing we were just talking about, which is feeling, right? Why do we value what we value? It's not really a rational process. It's an emotional process, and it has to do with, you know, contingencies of personal history and so on and so forth, right? And meaning obviously grows out of value, right? I'm doing something to say that I'm doing something meaningful, to say I'm doing something that's connected to that which I find valuable. I don't find the search for status valuable. I don't find becoming a doctor valuable just because I'm just doing it because my father told me I have to. But I find this meaningful because it's about things that I find valuable, things that I feel attached to. Okay, so when we talk about meaning, we're still in the realm of feeling. That doesn't mean it's bad. It's necessary. That's what motivates us, right? We literally can't do anything unless, I mean, we can literally do things, but I mean, we go where our emotions are, okay? But then there's this other thing that we've been talking about that you just framed, okay? And I don't want to make a cheap dichotomy, but there's also this thing called reason and facts and observations and reality, right? So you're an Antifa kid in Portland, and you are trying to bring down the whole system by smashing a shop window. Is this going to work? Is that going to bring the system down? And if it did bring the system down, do you have something to replace it? Have you thought these things through? Have you taken other people's perspectives and needs into account? Or are you simply acting therapeutically out of your own psychic needs?
Yeah. You're talking to me so sincerely, I'm beginning to think I am a member of Antifa in Portland. However, I've moved to Ann Arbor, so that can't be possible. Facts win the day here. Let me return to kind of a core thrust of our conversation. I really appreciate your being willing to kind of dive into that, connecting the Excellent Sheep. But I want to come back to things that you change your mind about in the course of your life and this new perspective on empire, on capitalism, on conservatism, and so on, that really was very recent. And I wondered if you had a thought about why that went out the window last.
Well, I don't know if it's last. We don't know what's coming up
so
yet.
Far. Thank you.
The barrier, at least for me, in letting in recognitions that I've been pushing away has been all to do with how it would force me to change the way that I see myself. Among other things, to recognize that I know much less than I thought I do. My opinions need to be much more tentative than I've ever thought. And having strong, certain, correct opinions has been central to my self-conception, to my ego for, as you know, I was going to say as long as I've been an adult, I think it's actually longer than I've been an adult. And I also think that we live at a time where that's more and more true for more and more people.
Yes.
That, you know, having strong, certain, correct opinions has become more central to our identity as an academic, as a thinker in general, as a person in general. I mean, I know it's a cliche. Oh, it's the search, it's open-ended, you never... The truth of those cliches have become more and more real to me as I've gotten older. This idea of perpetual doubt. I mean, I think I might have paid lip service to it, but like, I really feel it now because of the things we've been talking about. Like, yeah, I do not hold my opinions the same way that I used to.
Yes. Yes. And I just want to make a distinction. You're not doubting everything. You're not questioning the value of everything. You're saying you hold it lightly.
I hold it more lightly.
Hold it more lightly.
I hold it more lightly. I mean, this is all sort of in my late 50s, which for one thing, I think is great. I think it's, I mean, I'm patting myself on the back, but I mean, personally, I'm grateful to know that I can have such significant changes of perspectives this late in life. That, you know, I haven't done all of my learning and all of my thinking.
Reflections. So, what did you learn from this conversation? I asked the question because I don't think you're just here as a spectator. You have things you're up to in the world, and maybe this conversation gave you some new ways to think about them. At least I sure hope so. So let me offer my two cents. First, the ability to grow and expand as adults can happen at any age. We know this first and foremost from brain science, from the notion of neuroplasticity. The brain simply isn't static, or as it's sometimes said, neurons that fire together, wire together. We also know this from the field of adult development, which studies not the hardwiring of the brain, but the subjective experiences of the mind. The mind's capacity to expand, to take on new perspectives, to outgrow old stories, and even to outgrow stories about those stories, exists in most of us throughout life. We may not grow. We may get stuck. We may even fall back. We may, at age 80, think and make sense of the world the same as we did at age 20. What happens or doesn't happen depends on a whole variety of forces both outside of us and within us. But the capacity to grow and expand our minds as adults is there. Second is the notion of hate listening that Bill talked about. In his case, it was listening to a radio station that for a long time was his home, but instead doing it and just plain hating the experience. I imagine you have something similar in your life, something you read or listen to because you've always done it, and then one day you realize it just doesn't cut it for you anymore. When you realize this, that's a really important moment. Third, I want to comment on a word that Bill and I discuss in this conversation, and that word is humility, being open to other perspectives, being open to being wrong, sometimes even actively looking for ways that you are off base, that you've missed facts, that you're making ungrounded assessments. In Bill's case, this touched me, and not just because humility is a wonderful virtue, but because it's something Bill has grown in himself, one step, one perspective, one lingering socialized value from childhood at a time. So I really love that. But let me add a disclaimer in here. It's an important disclaimer, and it falls into the category of different strokes for different folks. In other words, what works for some doesn't work for others. Here is the disclaimer. I'm 100% for people learning to take on different perspectives and look for ways they might be off base. That definition of humility in general. But in many individual cases, humility may not be the best recipe for your situation or the most important growth edge for your life. In fact, if you interpret humility in a certain way, as say, keeping your ideas to yourself or not trusting your own opinion, which isn't what Bill means but is very common, being humble might for you be counterproductive. I've worked with many people whose pattern is not overconfidence, but instead playing too small. It's hard for them to advocate for what they want or what they believe. It's hard for them to take stands, to speak with conviction. And in fact, in my case, for the first decade of adulthood, I used to be a lot like this. So, if this sounds like how you are wired, let me say this. Yes, it can be helpful at times to hold your ideas more lightly. And it might be useful in many other situations to speak powerfully from your center of power, from what matters to you. Once again, different strokes for different folks. And finally, a few words about NPR. And here's one way Bill and I differ at least a little bit. Although I've listened to NPR for a long time, I've never considered it to be my home. I've always listened to it as one of many sources of news and commentary. One reason is that for a long time, I thought of NPR as being just too bland, not asking hard enough questions of politicians I disagreed with, and being too willing to go along with the unfortunate journalistic game of false equivalences. I remember one time screaming at the radio when an NPR reporter was interviewing George W. Bush and failing to ask a probing question that seemed absolutely obvious, at least to me. This is, of course, a bit like how Bill got frustrated by NPR not asking hard enough questions about the anti-racism movement. Similar frustration, different focus. And yet, I do still listen to NPR today. Not all the times, but sometimes. And my general attitude towards NPR, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, the National Review, when I don't expect it to do everything for me, I can take the best and jettison the rest. Thanks for listening. If you believe in this show, like what you're hearing, or simply don't know what to do with yourself for the next 60 seconds, please leave me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. This show is produced in Detroit by Zach Rosen.